Poppy Burton Morgan, welcome to Theatre Voice. You are in the middle of rehearsing Arab Nights, which is about to open at the Soho Theatre in a couple of weeks.
Next week.
Gosh, very soon. Thank you for sparing some time to tell us about the project. In a nutshell, I would say this is something that brings together a number of short new writing pieces, short new plays, in the context of a sort of a rather older structure, that of the Arabian Nights. Tell us a little bit about that. Sounds like a really exciting project.
It's an incredibly exciting project. And the idea for it really was born, came from three different strands of what was going on in my mind. Last year, I directed a production of Arabian Nights, which was the kind of traditional family version that we all think in this country is what Arabian Nights is about, with, you know, Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves and circus and puppetry and kind of magic. And that introduced me to the tales, and I fell in love with them as sort of the magic of the storytelling. And I was talking to Chris Hayden at the Gate Theatre about 66 books, which they did at the Bush, which was a multi-author response to the books within the Bible. And the responses were quite imaginative. One of them was a tap dance. One of them was used Twitter. So it was a multi-author response that seemed a bit more imaginative than just some people write some plays. And then the final thing was, we've been out, my husband and co-artistic director William Reynolds and I have been out to the West Bank in Palestine a few times working on projects not through Meta Theatre. So we already had an interest in the region. And all of these things kind of came together in my mind, and I thought the Scheherazade frame story of 1001 Nights was a brilliant vehicle to tell some new tales about what's going on there, but to tell them in a way that was a bit more imaginatively engaged than simply, here's a play about what's going on in Syria, here's a play about the revolutions in Egypt. And also to then work with writers from all those regions and hopefully create something where they speak to each other rather than, again, just plays in isolation happening in a sequence.
That sounds like an amazing challenge to take on. So you drew together the writers, you commissioned them.
Yeah.
How did you go about doing that?
It was a very organic process. One of the writers, our Palestinian writer, Raja Shahadi, we had worked with one of the projects in the West Bank. And so we had a personal relationship with him already. We just approached him. And then others, friends of friends and Facebook. And it was amazing, actually, how much social media played a part in facilitating all of the connections, because we're not a big company, we don't have huge resources. I couldn't fly out to all these countries and meet with lots of writers, and we weren't even able to commission, you know, hundreds or tens of plays. We had to commission the plays that we commissioned were the plays that we were going to produce, so we had to get exactly the six right people and exactly the six right plays, which luckily we did. But it was very the only way I can describe it really is organic, because there was no plan of we need a writer from this country, in this country, in this country. But it fell out in such a beautifully that we had writers from six different countries, three male, three female, some old, some young, some Christian, some Muslim, some secular, and of a totally different styles. So some playwrights, but also novelists, journalists, a live artist, a storyteller. So it meant that they were responding to the brief in such diverse ways, and then talking about what was going on in their particular country. So hopefully it's an incredibly rich tapestry of tales.
That's brilliant. So the original 1001 Nights was a story that sort of evolved through the oral tradition, and you have in some way reinvented that for the 21st century, and you're doing it via social media and email. So you're working with writers that presumably some of them you haven't met.
Yes, some of them. Well, our Iranian writer, who's writing anonymously, can't leave Iran, so I've never met him and I may never meet him. And we've spoken on the phone, but we've had lots of late night emails. But we've also, I've got a small baby, and so he's seen photos of him on Facebook, and we tweeted each other. So strangely, we've managed to forge quite a deep connection through all these social media without ever meeting. And our Egyptian writer, I hadn't met until we'd emailed back and forth and back and forth, and then she was performing in London, and I only met her a few weeks ago. So it's been a strange, huge international collaboration that's been kind of very on a very low budget and just through the wonders of modern technology.
That's amazing. How has that do you think impacted on the work itself? Because obviously, if you're working with a new writer, it would be great to have them in the rehearsal room and you can work through and make changes to their work.
Well, it's been really interesting, partly because some of them work in other disciplines like journalism or novels or live storytelling. They've put a lot of trust in me and given me, I think, a lot more freedom than a director might normally have with a writer, because the majority of them haven't been in rehearsals at all, or if they have, they've come in very fleetingly at the beginning. And several of them have said, because for most of them, English isn't their first language as well. So early on, there was quite a long dramaturgical conversations back and forth where I would suggest changes and edits. And through that, hopefully we have built up enough trust that they could say, sort of, do what you like in rehearsals and we trust you to make it work on stage. And I think particularly Shireen, our Egyptian storyteller, recognises that until it's up on its feet and we're playing with it, you know, the structure might change and words might change and lines, you know, and they've given me a lot of freedom to sort of adapt that. And then some of them, we haven't changed anything and we've just been very true to the text. And again, that feels like it's honouring. So I've sort of approached each one differently and it's been about honouring the intentions behind each piece.
And those pieces that you then have, those short stories, they sit within this framework of the Arabian Nights. How have you managed that? Is that updated too, or is that the traditional setting?
Well, that's a very good question. In some ways, it has a foot in two worlds. I mean, Shahrazad is the first person we meet, and it's obvious that it'll be obvious from the set and the costumes, we're not in kind of 9th century Persia with, you know, magical lanterns and colourful whatever. It's quite a kind of contemporary, it's a very obviously contemporary and slightly bleak world. But the language still has a kind of magical storytelling heightened quality. So I've said to the performers, and in fact in the very first stage direction, that we're simultaneously in a world of genies and sultans and also demonstrations and revolution. So hopefully we've managed to bridge both of those worlds and create our own sort of theatrical reality that honours both.
But the storytelling is still this sort of magical, redemptive...
Absolutely,
force.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and that was where one of the big sources of using this as the kind of the vehicle for these new tales came from, because what Shahrazad is doing, even in the original, is using the power of the spoken word and using the power of speech to effect change and to redeem this the tyrant, the dictator, and sort of change him rather than through being beautiful and sexy or through violence. It's through the power of everyday speaking and speaking to him and melting his heart with the magic of stories. So that absolutely was the key to it all, and is still the key to it all.
And do you have a dictator figure, or is that something that you don't really deal with?
Well, without giving too much away, there's a very small cast. It's a cast of three. There's an actress playing Shahrazad, and then an actress playing her sister and an actor playing her brother. So very early on, we established a convention whereby initially one audience member and then the whole audience become Sultan Shahrayar. So they, after each tale, they decide whether to hear another tale. And if they decide not to hear another tale, then Shahrazad dies. But also that's the end of the play. So it could well be that when the audience come in, they hear the first tale and she asks if they'd like to hear another. And if they don't respond, and if they just sit there silently, then the play will only be 20 minutes long. And that's a very real, genuinely real choice for the audience. And I've said to the actors, you know, you must try and convince them, but if you can't convince them, then absolutely the play stops after one tale or two or three or five or, yeah.
So how have you chosen which tale to make the first, the one that you definitely get?
Well, the order is really interesting. And I, in fact, just in rehearsals today, I was saying, you know, I was talking about how I worked out the order for the six, because some of them work very well with each other back to back because of certain themes that are the same or certain sort of physical things that happen that are kind of mirrored. One of them, from the moment I read it, I knew it would be the end piece because it engages directly with the Shahrazad story and sort of provides the resolution to that. But the opening play, which is a version of Sinbad, I think I chose that. I mean, it's it's brilliant. They're all brilliant, but it's brilliant. And it really, it engages with every aspect of the brief, which I gave the writers, in that it takes an existing tale from the 1001 Nights, the tale of Sinbad, and it reworks that into a sort of modern political allegory for an unnamed Islamist state. And it embraces puppetry, and it embraces live music, all of which I had put in my writer's brief and said, if you'd like to engage with this, these are things that at Meta Theatre we like to play with, kind of all the storytelling tools that we have and meta-theatricality. And so it sort of most exemplified what I was trying to create. So I went, tick, you get to go first.
So that's interesting. The brief that you issued to the playwrights actually asked them to engage with one of the traditional stories and to update that?
No, that was how he chose to respond to it. In terms of content, I was very free with them because I wanted them to be able to tell the stories that they wanted to tell. So I said, in some way respond to the idea of the Arab uprisings or the Arab Spring, and in some way use the framing device of 1001 Nights. So some of them took that to mean updating an existing tale. For some of them, it was about inventing a new tale, but very much in the language or the style of the old tales. Some of them don't really engage that much with the 1001 Nights theme at all. And then some of them subtly either allude to it as a title or pull quotes from it or use the tropes of it, like stories within stories, embedded narratives, in a much more contemporary tale. But all of them actually have created very contemporary pieces. So although they kind of hark back to an older storytelling world and tradition, we know very explicitly that we're in Tahrir Square or we're in Damascus or we're in an unnamed but clearly contemporary North African state.
So you have these different tales and they're all very different, but they're held together because they're performed by the same ensemble and they're within the same framework. How do you think of the show? Do you think of it as a number of separate pieces, or is it clearly in your head, is it one entity?
It is definitely one entity. And for me, again, I find that multi-author response to an idea or a theme where 6 or 10 plays have been written in isolation for each other and directed by different directors, or even by the same director, I find it a bit difficult if there's not a sort of an aesthetic through line or some, you know, picking out of themes that kind of link them. Because it feels a bit like getting a taster menu from a restaurant or getting a taster menu from 12 different restaurants rather than something that's been thought through and has a narrative of its own. Having said that, it's really important that you honour the intentions of each individual play and you don't kind of shoehorn a play into your concept. And so certainly in terms of the design, which is quite striking and involves 1001 shoeboxes, the designer who's also my husband and I had many long discussions into the night about how to honour each play in and serve each play, and some of them call for very specific props or items of costume and also create a world that had its own kind of aesthetic coherence and unity. Hopefully we've done that.
With the shoeboxes. And you touched earlier on all the different elements of theatricality, the meta theatricality that you as a company bring to a show. Do you want to tell me about that and how that fits into this production, the different qualities of performance that you bring to it and what that gives to the show?
Well, partly it was in the brief in terms of, trying to respond a bit more imaginatively to some very difficult situations and some very harrowing stories. And there's absolute, and that, you know, I know those plays are out there that talk about rape and talk about torture and talk about the kind of the horrors of what's going on. But as theatre makers, we also, absolutely, we have to tell those tales, but we also have to entertain and we have to conjure a world for the audience. And so for me, it was about using all the storytelling tools we had, be that puppetry or be that video or be that live music, and reaching, which I think allows us to reach an audience who wouldn't necessarily come to see political theatre with a capital P, but also allows us to reach people on a different level, the words are absolutely given precedence and prominence and it's about the storytelling and spoken word, but there are also layers of storytelling there that aren't verbal. And that feels really important in terms of unlocking, because they're so rich. I mean, the original 1001 Nights, but also the pieces that have been written are so rich in metaphor and symbolism. And using all those theatrical tools, I think, helps to unlock that language, particularly for a Western audience who are a bit less used to reading symbolism and kind of metaphor in theatre, I think.
And perhaps takes some of the sort of the horror of what you're talking about one level away, so it just makes it a little bit easier to deal with.
Yeah, and not, I mean, I don't want to make it easy for an audience, but at the same time, it's really important that you get an audience on side and that you lead them into something maybe gently, and then you confront them with a difficult thing, or even that you turn something into a symbol or a metaphor so that it doesn't hit you, you don't hit them over the head with it. And it may be a day later, it may be weeks later, that they read a news story and it suddenly clicks for them, and it suddenly resonates on a level that they weren't necessarily conscious of.
You mentioned political theatre with a capital P, and obviously these new pieces are very contemporary. They've just been written, they're here and now. Is this a piece that you think will only exist now, or do you think it's something that could be revisited, could work in another time?
Well, I'd love for it to have a future life. We're hoping it's going to tour next year and maybe internationally in 2014, but the kind of imperative to make it happen quickly was very much because when you're talking about current issues, they only remain current for a certain time. And after a certain point, if you revisit something, it becomes a different thing. It becomes a period piece. It becomes like revisiting Carol Churchill's Top Girls, and suddenly you're doing a play about the 80s rather than, you know, when it was originally written and it was it felt like a very contemporary thing. So I'd hope they absolutely have in them the sort of strength and integrity to last, but things that very specifically reference events, which several of them do, several of them talk about particular things that happened in 2011, I think there's a limit to how long you can kind of do that and still feel current. So if, say, it happened next year and the year after, and then in 10 years time we wanted to revive it, I'd probably think quite hard about how we might rework the tales to become more universal.
Or commission new pieces.
Or commission new pieces, absolutely.
Yeah. So, finally, we're just drawing to a close, but what, if you're thinking about your audience and they're leaving the theatre after the show, what do you hope them to be thinking or feeling or to come away with? What's the message?
Well, there are so many messages. I mean, each piece has its own message, and I don't even want to talk about what those particular messages are, because hopefully the writers have made their intentions very clear in their particular works, and our job is to serve those intentions. I mean, there are threads that are woven throughout it of dreams and of the future and of hope. Because again, I think there's a kind of vogue for presenting the horror and the it makes for good drama, that, you know, the horror and the conflict in maybe a more kind of verbatim way, but I think a more imaginative response allows us to think about what the future, in some cases maybe what the future might look like, or handing over the baton to the future generations and how we might think about moving forward in those regions and in some very kind of sticky situations. And I don't think that these plays are going to, you know, bring peace in the Middle East, but hopefully they would just spark some ideas in the audience's mind about how things might change, or at least provoke them to go away and find out a bit more about what's going on in some of these countries. But yeah, hopefully there's a kernel of hope in there. I'm just going to keep saying the word hope.
Lovely. Thank you very much.